Hey folks, welcome to the Brilliant Body Podcast, a forum to learn about and liberate the brilliance of your body and ultimately to expand the meaning and experience of intelligence. Join me, Ali Mazay, and other body masters to explore pioneering and varied perspectives on what it means and feels like to be embodied. So join us and reclaim your body's brilliance. Welcome to this call, our most recent event with the brilliant Rachel Fell of the Brilliant Body Podcast Event Brights, that series that we're doing. And I'm so happy you're here, Rachel, and not just here on this call, but I wouldn't be nearly as far along in my business, in my life, and perhaps the podcast wouldn't be in existence, or at least not yet, if it weren't for your expert guidance and coaching and beautifully compassionate, attuned, and creative guidance. So I really want to thank you very much for, I still have a bunch of lingering questions, and clearly people who are joining us today have their own questions, I hope. So I'm going to ask a few, and then we'll open it up to the group. Mm-hmm. Let's just begin by the question of what is neurodiversity, and how do you define it? How do you experience it? I think that's the best place to start, because even Flo and I, we were talking about it earlier, and we're kind of like, yeah, what is it exactly? It's so often conflated with autism, with all kinds of connotations that I don't believe you put on it. So,
yeah. I almost couldn't be in all of the kindness you just bestowed upon me around the podcast and the journey. Thank you for that. And yeah, it's been a joy to walk with you in it. And I super believe in somatic intelligence, nonverbal intelligence. Zooming out to explore the nature of human intelligence feels really, really important right now. And so kudos to you and Brilliant Body for doing that. And neurodiversity is a huge part of that. I just pulled up one of my many keynotes that I have open on my laptop all the time. You know, human neurological diversity. Neurodiversity. So there's this truth that there's this unseen diversity within all of us. Like, no two nervous systems are born alike or have the same experiences. And because human beings are this open learning system that stores memory and association and meaning, no two nervous systems, no two experiences are exactly alike. And so when we look at how neurology works and that sort of nature-nurture reciprocity, that feedback loop of experience that human beings have, it's just taking a moment to acknowledge that no two experiences are alike and that no two nervous systems, no two brains operate the same way.
So it isn't necessarily relative to the powers that be, or is it? Because it sounds like you're defining it that this includes all of us, as opposed to this only includes those of us who don't conform to a specific way of processing either information or the world.
Yeah. So it's almost like neurodiversity is the parent umbrella category. It's a biological truism, essentially. And then within that, we can talk about neurodivergence and neurocomplexity, which gets into those sort of, well, who decides what's normal and what's classed as divergent? What models do we use to basically measure and or identify and or engage there? But this parent concept of neurodiversity is like a little bit more zoomed out. Same species, same amazing, beautiful, brilliant body structure at the species level taxonomically, but then each individual is unique and different. And so each person has this unique neuro fingerprint, which is flexible and can evolve and change because we as humans evolve and change. But within that, if we zoom in and come in a little bit further, we can see that some people's processing is markedly different. And that's identified in childhood, it's identified maybe in adulthood, labels, language, and neurodivergent categories, let's say, like autism or like CPTSD, we can use these to help us start to explore and understand a person's unique neurodivergence. So neurodiversity is up here, and then neurodivergence is those categories or those ways that we group and see those differences.
Aha. So autism, you would call a subcategory of neurodiversity?
Neurodivergence as, yeah, like a bucket or a category or like a way we as humans see and make meaning of a divergent neurological experience. So that's where it gets a little trippy with the non-duality thing. Can we hold that everybody is unique and different and there are these marked sort of categories, buckets, commonalities of difference in processing? And this is where the brilliance of the body, I mean, neurodivergence is physiological. We're on the very sort of edges of starting to explore that. But let's say synaptic pruning in autism is something that's being studied and well known. I'm really interested in the permeability of the cells. So how are people neurosomatically diverse or divergent? I suspect that we would find, if we had the technology and ways of seeing, that we'd be able to understand this physiologically as well. And we see this with autism and Ehlers-Danlos or connective tissue disorders, for example.
Okay, so we're going to unpack some of that.
Yeah. Sorry, I jumped right in, didn't I?
Synaptic pruning. I've not heard that term before. I'd love to know what that is. Let's start there.
Yeah. So I'm going to refer back to my handy presentation that I have here. So neuronal action might be different. So this gets us into, I know you had Sarah on the last Q&A, and this gets into the neuroscience piece. So basically how our synapses maintain their structures in the brains. Maybe some of us have seen those videos of a neuron reaching out for another neuron under a microscope, these sorts of things, that the neuronal action itself in some individuals is different, perhaps more excitable, perhaps there's more branching, let's say. So that gets into that world in which I'm not like a expert. I know pretty high level stuff, but that's where we can dive in and get into the details and the weeds.
Well, I can really respond to that as a decades-long body worker, that there is no doubt about it that people's synapses fire very, very differently, because I can feel it and I can track it. And I can also work with it and negotiate with it and accentuate it. So that's a whole conversation in and of itself, but certainly how a body has lived its advantages and disadvantages, I can very well imagine and see and experience, really affects how neurological energy, electricity, consciousness, whatever you want to call it, does or doesn't move through the body in the ways that it does or doesn't in any given body. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And this gets us into really fascinating questions around neuronal action and consciousness and sub and unconscious and the body as the sub and unconscious, which I won't load that on the front end, but that's, yeah, I mean, that gets right to that place.
Yeah, I do want to get into at some point, though. Oftentimes, I'll speak for myself, it's easy to think about autism and certain manifestations of autism as what is referred to as neurodivergent. And I know from some of my work that there can be damage to the reflexes of the body that correlates to some degrees or some forms of autism, that the body can very much reflect and be implicated in whether or not a brain or a relational capacity is functioning or not functioning. And we talked about in episode 2 about your athleticism, for example, and how intensively physical you grew up and are, as well as being extraordinarily sensitive. And I think you would even say, or you did describe, as thinking with your body. So if you want to go for the relationship between neurodiversity and the body, let's do it. Or we can wait a little longer before I'm going to ask you about it again.
Yeah, just gathering myself in that. I feel like it's twofold. We're not taught that the body is one big brain or that we are a sensing instrument. We are conditioned to conceive of ourselves as thinkers in a very specific way. And that mental mapping, that sort of constructing, primes us and our experience. So I can't talk about the second part without acknowledging that. Like, how would humans experience their own body brilliance if children and if human beings were conditioned to understand that their body is essentially one big brain, that we are intelligent, sentient, full body? This brings us into that Cartesian divide territory that you and I like to jam on. once that was uninstalled in me, then I could see this stuff a lot more clearly. I think I could see myself a lot more clearly and be really curious about my own experience of how I perceive and process. So ironically, because it's all, we're all one thing, that uninstalling those constructs that kept me from seeing that truth or experiencing that and seeing myself in that way was actually really the first step in a lot of ways.
I am always dazzled by the fact that you're a professional roller derbyist, and we talked about it in episode 2, but I do want to bring it up again because even my thinking about it, my imagining it, the speed by which that's happening and the amount of data that you would have to track in a physical way to not wipe out or wipe somebody else out seems to me such a perfect living metaphor for the thinking body.
Yeah. Psychomotor, physical intelligence, what it takes to play an instrument or, roller derby. So opening up our definition of thinking, playing with language, I'm really, really interested in where somatics and language meet. And so seeing that as thinking, conceptualizing that as thinking, mentally mapping that as thinking, that's the sub and unconscious. I don't have to consciously register those things. I don't have to have lucid thought around those types of reactions in those spaces, that direct pathway from sensing, seeing all of the input into action. Yeah, it's wacky how real time that is. And that's brilliant. And that's not thinking, or is it?
Or is it?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to ask you a couple more questions before I turn it over, which is not easy to do because I could talk to you for hours and days and hopefully will for years. But would you talk about giftedness and potentially the relationship between giftedness and neurodiversity? And also what I've heard you describe almost as a dilemma because of your political views and your distaste for anything elitist. So how do we acknowledge what is extraordinary and at the same time stay within a communal identity?
Unseen physiological difference, neurological difference would be unseen. It's happening inside the body. Somatic difference, this permeability piece, which I think is definitely part of the equation and we're starting to talk about. And by permeability,
I just want to slow that down for a moment. Moment, you're actually talking about the consistency of the tissue, of the fascia, right?
And yes.
As well as, I'm going to add this, a potentially energetic aspect to that. I don't know if you do, but
yeah.
I would posit that there's an aspect that's also purely energetic, if those two can even be separated. Yeah. But
well, this is the intersection of physics and physiology. And this is fascinating space that challenges our self-concept. And I love hanging out here. So physics and physiology, there is a lot of research going on right now, but this idea that at the extracellular level, if you zoom in to the stuff we're made of at a more microscopic level, all humans have collagen and elastin as part of the primordial goop that their cells swim in, which is called the extracellular matrix. And so every person has a different combination of this elastin and collagen, and it changes through a lifetime. But yes, permeability at the cellular level. So if you stay on this physics line, physics, physiological, in this zone, well, yeah, I don't stop at my skin. My heart has an electromagnetic field. Scientists measure this. My husband did a leadership training. They pulled him up on stage and made an example of him. They measured his heart field, his torus. This is the edge of where we dabble. And so it stands to reason that we are energetic physical beings, this material immaterial thing that we have divided. Like, I don't think Descartes really meant for it to go, I think, therefore I am, as like a disembodying thing, but that's what happened. And then exacerbated. So coming back to permeability, if a person is taking in more information for whatever reasons, cellular, neurological combination of those two things. My nervous system is connective tissue. So there is this physiological neurodivergent difference. And then how consciousness and the organism works with those differences and how those express are absolutely varied. and back to neurodiversity, but then yes, neurodivergences and giftedness as a form of neurodivergence, which has a physiological basis, starting from that bottom up place feels like a good starting point to me.
So are you saying there may very well be a big correlation between giftedness and permeability?
Yeah, and maybe all neurodivergences. Like, we use the DSM. We have a lot of research. There's also the neurodivergent space is very active and how we identify why we're doing these things. These are all big, big questions that we have. But we know that humans process differently. And so giftedness as a type of neurodivergence, or maybe as an expression of different types of neurodivergences, we're trying to sort that out. There's a lot of qualitative research, what it is and what it isn't. We know there are some commonalities. What it's not is straight A's and achievement orientation. It's something different than that.
Speaking of creativity, I'm going to ask you one last question and then we're going to turn it over to the group. You have such a beautiful way of applying this multidimensional way of thinking to coaching and to creative strategy, which is, I can speak for myself, helped me massively to really understand the fractal nature of my purpose and what I've always done and how to weave that into understanding that everything I've done has the same signature, basically the same mission to it. Mm-hmm. And so in that marketing, we had a conversation a few days ago about resonance and authenticity and how much is important to really share or not share with the public. So this is a big change of topic, but I wanted to bring it a little less heady, how to really put ourselves out in the world in as genuine, authentic, and heartful a way as possible without oversharing, without exposing too much vulnerability, too much personal history or current, in my case, a few days ago, despair about the world and what's going on in it. So just curious if you wanted to speak to that at all, just bringing in what you actually do for a living, which is to help people come out in the world, really, in a variety of ways.
Yeah. For me, self-inclusion is super, super important. And so this gets into our relationship with our own bodies, our thoughts, our emotions, the flow of information and intelligence as it moves through us. And so the self with self relationship, that being in the human experience and observing it, really coming from a co-creative place, that fractal, it's like, well, we're always being influenced and we're always influencing. That becomes the basis of self-attunement, which is, where am I now? And what am I pointing at? And what do I want? And why? And the kind of self-reflection, it's self-inclusive self-reflection. And from there, moving in the world in ways that we choose, in ways that challenge us, and that are really an extension of what we're finding in that self with self relationship. So doing that with people when it's more on the personal side and exploring their identity, maybe they're going through sort of a metamorphosis or positive disintegration, or maybe they've just discovered they're neurodivergent. Like, who am I? And that question is so beautiful and eternal and rich. As related to work in the world, organizations, starting a business, startup, solopreneur, even bigger organizations, it's the same thing. It's that self-inclusion and that awareness of, what am I doing? Who are we? What do we want? And in this case, we becomes the group or the person in relationship to the work that they do in the world. And so orientation is a big part of it. Self-inclusion and orientation is huge. And then from there, really finding that balance of challenge, like generative challenge, pushing yourself at those limits, but also honoring what's coming up for you and where those limits are. So the signature of authenticity is not transparency per se, but it's measured through your own experience. It's measured through your own reflection, your own judgment, let's say, of how that feels.
It sounds like what you're saying is it's very much relative to your own very personal and moment-to-moment process. What could feel too vulnerable one day or one moment in the way one would say it that day in that moment might be entirely appropriate and quite powerful to share a different day in a different way, perhaps, or maybe even the same, but it would be different because you wouldn't necessarily be in the pit of that despair at the time you do it. Is that fair?
Yeah. Your center of gravity is within. Your center of discernment is within. You are the one that moves from a place of awareness in your own motivations and what you're doing and why and these sorts of things. And so trusting yourself essentially is what it boils down to, trusting yourself. And that's a simple thing to say. And it's very deep and rich if we're being truly honest with ourselves, to move with confidence, even in doubt, these sorts of things, especially when we're in these liminal spaces of transformation or change or uncertainty, that gets extra squishy.
Yeah, particularly when, in this case, since we launched the podcast, it's been like a stretch pretty much every day for the last many months, because from that is becoming the next thing, and then another event, and then another interview, and even being here with you all and not knowing who's listening and how it's being received. That vulnerability, which you very much include in our work together, and I assume your work with everybody else, even if it's an individual or a whole group or organization, is taking into account our tender humanness, which can seem very counterculture to how we've been taught, like, oh, you're supposed to only present, I'm strong and I know exactly what I'm doing and I've been doing this forever, when really, holy shit, I haven't done this before and I've been doing a lot, so I hope I know what I'm doing, but I'm here and I'm here with what I've got and I'm here with all of you with what you've got, you know? It's that cutting edge, almost like a wound is growing back and you see the tender skin that's moving something together to become whole again. That's the image I'm getting right now.
I mean, a co-creative paradigm asks us to be mindful of both influencing and being influenced.
Mm-hmm.
And that is very different from any sort of power over dynamic. Self-inclusion is a way we can move to a co-creative paradigm.
And more inclusive one, which I know is a huge cornerstone value of yours and something I really appreciate.
Yeah, inclusive of the truth of energy and motion, emotions, back to that sort of space of like how we hold meaning and constructs through language. I am sad is different than I feel sad, than I am feeling sad in this moment. Beneath the word sad, there's an entire litany of body intelligence that is moving biochemically or nervous system, all of these things that translate into emotions and thoughts. One of the edgiest things I say to people is, you are not your thoughts or your emotions. You're having them, or they're flowing through you. We identify with them so intensely and we grab onto them, or we're like, I thought this thing, it's currency. My idea is amazing. Or I thought this, it must be true. And so this is where there's this really fun little gap that physics and physiology can bridge meditation over to this more, let's say, objectively oriented consensus reality place. You get people interested when you're like, yeah, your thoughts and emotions are just flowing through you. That's a physiological process. And then they'll be like, what? They might like that, and they might not like that so much. Doesn't mean there are not many other things, but they are processes that are moving through your body.
And again, including all that too. And speaking of inclusion, by the way, we have a question from the group, but I also want to include Flo, my brilliant co-producer, who's fielding the chat. And if you have a question that you don't want to ask out loud with your voice, you're welcome to put in the chat and let us know if you'd rather it remain anonymous too, so you don't have to be directly attached to the question. And as Philip Shepherd says regularly, no question is a dumb question. So please feel free to ask anything that comes to you. Okay, let's see. We have this question. If you could write the script for how this awareness and understanding would become more commonplace within our world society, how do you envision that? I.e., how do we collectively get from here to the there we want to see?
Yeah, beautiful. So this gap or this space between the inner and outer worlds, or I'm using this language of self-inclusion as a shorthand for that. I feel like based on a person's interest, a group's relational dynamic, the things they're interested in, what they hold dear, where they're oriented, going there and finding ways to bridge this particular divide, which it is this material, immaterial, self-location, self-inclusion thing. So I go to physics and physiology because that's super interesting to me. And it could go that more academic route or the route of people who are very much more looking at it from a very science first, external first, reductionist first perspective. But there are other ways to do this. The exercise that I do with everyone, I talk about orientation of consciousness, and I have people close their eyes and physically put their hands over their eyes. And to tune into the scroll within, I make a joke, like we're always scrolling, right? Imagine a river flowing bottom up in your body and your consciousness. I love Star Trek, love sci-fi. Your consciousness is like the Enterprise and you're out in the reaches of deep space and it's dark. It's dark inside your body. So you're just tuning in and what is emerging? What are you finding in that darkness? And then working with people to really slow that down in the spirit of an explorer who's safe, to not need to name too quickly, not need to synthesize too quickly, to be really curious about what emerges there. That's different for everybody. So when I do one-on-one work, there's a lot of that. And each person has a different, let's say, tolerance for that. So that is reframing meditation and tuning in interoceptively. The tricky part is that humans really want to make meaning real fast. And so learning to slow that down and just be in inner space. I know Gil Headley talks about being a somanaut, same idea. Having it have meaning for each person is important. So I use Star Trek. Some people like the Mariana Trench. Something that's fascinating to maybe highlight here is that my experience of my inner world is very black. I don't have a very visual experience. And so that lends me into that sensory deprivation immediately. I also don't have a strong inner monologue. So when I do this, I'm in the dark. For some people, dark is scarier than others. Finding a way that's interesting to a person to engage that inner space is really important. Whatever metaphors or analogies, some people it's find the light in your body, find where the energy is hanging out. Or for some people, the bottom up thing seems to be important because that kind of takes you out of that well-worn path of being in your thinking consciously in your head. But yeah, it's different for each person.
Yeah, mine isn't, I don't feel darkness inside my body. Actually, that's not my experience. So yeah, it is interesting how, as you're saying, how diverse we all are in our experience of self, for sure.
Yeah. How do you access that place?
Yeah.
Yeah, that place.
Ready for another question?
Sure.
Okay. I think this might be a continuation of that last question. This is regarding influencing versus being influenced within the whole body brain. Do you believe, feel, practice methods of affecting the body with intention from the mind, e.g. meditative healing, mood alteration, etc., personally or within your professional guiding role?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Brilliant. Yes. The vagus nerve runs 80 up and 20 down. So most human beings don't have a map of themselves processing information emergently. That's what I was just speaking about, is this guiding bottom-up consciousness mapping. The 20 down is also very powerful, interesting, important. So yeah.
Oh, just so it's clear, what do you mean by 80 what or 20 what?
The vagus nerve is bringing a lot of information from across your body together, and it's moving it directionally up through your body for registration this way, up into your brain. The brain's also communicating through the vagus nerve 20% downwards. So it's sending cues for voluntary, involuntary movement, heart beating, all that good autonomic stuff I don't have to think about. So there's a reciprocity there that's always happening, we tend to forget, and it's not terribly well socialized, that so much of that information flow, the brunt of it is coming 80% bottom up. And then that 20% of meditating on hand warming is one that I can think of right away, or really visualizing. You're guiding your own visualization and you're sending your own consciousness to certain places in your body, let's say, or you're playing with that mind-body connection in a directive way. Yeah.
So can you give an example of a meditative healing mood alteration that you might recommend? Give us a whirl on that.
Yeah. So to start, that sort of tuning in and dropping in and bringing the consciousness inward is that first step, especially in such a dopamine-oriented external situation that we find ourselves in. There's this tuning in first that I find personally to be imperative. And then from there, am I listening? Am I guiding? And that becomes a really interesting dance. And so the listening would be like what emerges out of the depths. The guiding might be guiding orange light into your hands and feet if you find that you're feeling cold, or not even if you're feeling cold. Like for me, there has to be less expectation on it. There has to be, it's not for a utilitarian end, but like sending warm light to certain places in the body and just witnessing what happens when you have that intention and you imagine that to be the case.
It's really interesting what you're describing, the difference between being with and receiving what is there, being available to what's there, as opposed to directly guiding it and, directing it, as this question is getting at. So it sounds like the question is both. You're both influencing and being influenced by.
The subtlety of that reciprocity within, tuning into that dance, let's say, ever more fine-tuned within the self. Because that influencing and being influenced is happening within ourselves too. It's like obviously ourselves, but our sub and unconscious communicating with our conscious, or let's say lucid waking awareness, that dance within the self. So for me, expectations seem to get in the way quite a bit. It's like, oh, I just want my hands to warm up, or I'm imagining this orange light and it's not happening. The second that starts, it's like, it's over. My orientation isn't to the achievement of the felt sense of warming. My orientation is to what can I notice? The intention remains, and what can I notice?
Do you also find that you flow back and forth in any given, let's say, meditation or session? And maybe this is the case throughout your day as well, that you actually toggle and oscillate back and forth between influencing and being influenced by your own interoception, your own internal state. So you might notice something and then you want to have an effect on it. And then that effect, something else emerges from it. I imagine that's kind of what we call life, huh?
Yep, the dance. And where am I now? And do I need to tune in? And do I want to consciously participate or redirect this? I don't want to make the entirety of the sub and unconscious conscious, because I'm really so glad and amazed that my body is so brilliant and that I don't have to consciously make my heartbeat. Think about that, you know? I do think we can deepen our relationship with our nonverbal intelligences that live in our bodies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, we have another question from the group. I love what you're saying about the cross-section between physiology and physics. How can I learn more about that? Any tips?
I follow my nose. I'm a pretty self-directed learner, maybe almost to a fault. But there are certain people who are exploring the space, certain thinkers. There's definitely some research and some scholarship, but this is very much like a frontier kind of space. Electrophysiology, for example, even the philosophical underpinnings of neuroscience, there's a lot of richness there. So I guess my best tip would be just what interests you about it more specifically, and then follow your nose, dig in and jump down the rabbit holes that seem appealing to you. For me, the electrophysiological, humans as electrical beings, the more microscopic than the systems level, this extracellular level, that just got really interesting to me. So I just kind of followed that interest.
That reminds me of how plants can be very much affected by current as well. Just curious whether you've looked into the crossover between how plants being affected by different metals and currents and music and all that interplays with how humans' tissue also responds, either similarly or not similarly. I don't know the science on it, but I'm wondering if you do.
Yeah, so the torus, the signature of the toroidal field, is present in pretty much everything, if not everything, that we would class as sentient or living. And so this frontier, this really interesting space of the influence of the unseen, which we know to be real, I'm breathing oxygen, light is all around me, these unseen components of reality that are less tangible to our physicality, how those influence our physical experience in the physical world, there's nothing more interesting to me than that space. So yeah, whether it's plants, human beings, which are amazingly complex, I mean, AI wishes it had a body, I feel like. Yeah, the influence and reciprocity of the unseen and the seen, that stuff.
Awesome.
Yeah, that maybe answered a question, but maybe not.
Anybody else want to continue on either that topic or any other? Yeah, go for it, Michael.
Hey, Rachel. I'm just curious, what edge are you most personally interested in exploring right now, and why that?
Can I volley back and ask you my growth edge, my personal life in my...
Maybe like field of thought or edge of field of thought. Is there anything that you're exploring the edge or where boundaries blur a little bit that is informing all the rest of your work?
Wow. Yeah. Honestly, our beliefs about belief. Probably how belief influences everything, the nature of belief as unseen structures that live in the body, somatic beliefs, let's say. Yeah, how we can relate with our sub and unconscious, and that's the pros and the cons that come along with being able to expand our experience of our own intelligence or to access these places and spaces that maybe are in those shadow lands a little bit, like how that influences our lived experience, that kind of stuff.
Just that comment about beliefs, it connects back to something that you said earlier about co-creation.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that process of belief about beliefs is inherently co-creation in a way.
Yeah. Something I come back to is the understructures of conditioning live in our bodies. So I'm going to go off on a little wander here to come back and speaking just very personally. So when I think about how ideology is woven into everything and even into like our DNA, so even into our bodies, a paradigm of, let's say, pagan or more indigenous cultures that are rooted in co-creativity and reciprocal influence, as opposed to a structure that is power over and, let's say, like original sin, or that there's this bifurcation of more than or less than hierarchical dynamics through the ideologies of, let's say, Christianity woven into Western culture that lives in my body. So I'm really interested in the structures of belief that come from conditioning over time and ideology over time. And we are so identified with our conscious, lucid experience. Well, we have the opportunity to go in and root out the oppressor within and root out the power over within. If we can get over this identification with consciousness, I know this, I believe this. I work with plenty of people and organizations who consciously believe something, but the body of the person or the body of the organization does not agree. So that's not lining up.
And so how do you see sort of that unfolding with social change and technological change seemingly speeding up?
Yeah, it would be this orientation to the influence of the inner world on the external, taking responsibility for one's own deep operating system.
Cool. Well, yeah. Thank you.
I hope that answered your question.
I have to add in here a little plug for the work that I'm doing, personal geometry, because it's all about externalizing our internal body maps, which would include our beliefs and how we relate to everything within ourselves and everything outside of ourselves, because the body knows exactly how we are or aren't aligned, and it can show you in literally seconds or minutes how you actually hold yourself in relation to any given thing or person or institution and will map it for you, diagram it for you immediately. So I just wanted to bring a visual or an actual physical experience of how we can actually see how we are holding, in this case, these beliefs that we have and the constituent parts that very much then influence how we can and can't relate to our spouses, children, animals, job, money, sexuality, all these different things. So just wanted to add that in.
Yeah. Yeah. The mapping thing, sometimes like I'll be working with somebody or a team of people who are so locked in the cognitive and like shifting them into a metaphorical exploration or giving them a creative exercise that they can still be in representational intelligence, but it's not using language. It's not being rational. It's not explaining in this very linear way, accessing that stuff through whether it's personal geometry or encouraging metaphor, imagery. These are ways we can surface this stuff. But a person's got to want to see it. An organization's got to want to see it. They have to have, I think, an ideological buy-in on their influence or on the sub and unconscious influence.
Good point. Because you're going to see it if you let the body show it to you. Yeah. If you're in denial or you want to gaslight yourself or your employees, definitely isn't going to work if you do this kind of work, for sure.
Or if you're just locked in the Cartesian, I think therefore I am, and there's one very narrow band of human experience and intelligence to access, and there's only one very specific and right way to do it.
So if you were queen of the universe, this gets back to the question a while ago about how would we see and create and influence more change to be more somatically based, including in our institutions and, for that matter, in our foreign policy.
Simple enough, I suppose. It's this shift to an existential reset on a fractal reality, on a co-creative paradigm. That's kind of happening. And power over structures. Look, it's like, I'm glad that I look both ways before I cross the street. I'm glad I have a survival body. I'm glad my nervous system has the capacity to know when to go binary, let's say, this or that, me or you, us or them. But fear is a huge piece of this. Being able to live collaboratively and co-creatively is going to take a massive shift in how we live. There are 8 billion people on the planet. I'm not trying to act like this is a small thing. But that starting with a level set on co-creative reality, that is the existential nature of our reality, seems like an important piece. The self-inclusion thing also seems really important. We have in other cultures through time that walking with people in the growth and development of their interiority, or working with the scroll within, or how we relate to the self, with the self as singular and in relationship, community dynamics, these things have been different. And now what we have, especially in the West, this paradigm of fix it mentality, body is machine, psyche is broken. You go to a therapist when you've reached a certain critical juncture in your own experience. So this cultivating self-attunement, it feels like that as a space that could grow could really help change things in this way, shifting culture to prioritize self-inclusion and to be able to teach this stuff at a broader scale.
Takes some imagination, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. But we keep trying, don't we?
Yeah, totally.
So there's another beautiful question. Considering that our operating systems are all unique, is there truly such a thing as a non-neurodivergent human? Perhaps the diversity of our cognitive processes means that neurodiversity encompasses all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is a really interesting space, and it's tricky because it's non-dual. Neurodiversity is that each person has their own unique neurological fingerprint. So your question earlier, Ali, about culture and when is a certain type of processing deemed divergent? Neurodiversity as a concept and a truth that was popularized by a group of autistic adults, and then this woman, Judy Singer, got credit for it. It was a group effort. Of course it was. And on her website, I think she says something like, nature is an amoral agent, that the second we introduce judgment and this piece around deciding what is normal, we're introducing a whole entire set of complexities around this piece. And so what is considered divergent is where personally I stay there. I know from my own experience and what I see externally that autism is real. It's true. And how we understand that, how we work with that, how we conceptualize it, how we scope it, humans have this exquisite representational intelligence. And so it gets sticky in here. It gets really interesting in here. It gets a little sticky. I go towards then, okay, well, my intention would be to support the thriving of humans and their contribution, their well-being, selves, others, the world around them. And so that would be my personal orientation. What's named divergent is entirely contextual. I'm not trying to get out of that question, I promise. It's just really tricky because, yeah, we are all unique neurofingerprints. And yes, some people are autistic or what we call that. And what that even means is like, whoa, do we know what that means? How do you scope that? How do you give that a box? That's a heck of a question.
Well, it seems a lot of that is based on how socially interactive people are. Mm-hmm. It's not just, can you think about things in this way? Can you compute this? Can you succeed academically or hold down a job? But it's also, can you relate? Can you be in relationship, personal or societal? Can you deal with touch? Can you deal with all the things that we tend to associate with healthy human interaction?
And that's where we get back to the physiological piece. I go right back there. Well, it's understanding sensory sensitivity. Yeah, you put five kiddos under the same fluorescent light and they're going to have five unique experiences. One of those kiddos might not be able to handle it. And it might be more noise for their body mind than they can handle. Is that kid divergent? All of the kids are probably not loving the fluorescent light, but some of them might. So this gets into neuro-inclusive practices. Inclusive practices tend to benefit everybody. And so you flip the paradigm the other way. Instead of being exclusive, you become inclusive and that benefits everybody. But yeah, sensory, relational, what is healthy? And again, this gets into our whole vision for a society, a world, that kind of stuff. How do we support thriving?
I don't know if you've seen the Wachowski sisters Sense8 series. Have you? Their view is, or the view of this series is that a fifth of the world's population has this extraordinary sensitivity. Philip Shepard considers intelligence and sensitivity pretty much to be one and the same. And yet sensitivities that some of us have can seem very off-putting and out of sync with what is expected of us to function in particular contexts. But I was wondering is there a direct correlation in your view and experience between neurodiversity and sensitivity?
Yeah, for me, this permeable piece is something I come back to, exploring this with my colleague, Ellen Heed. Her and I have explored this quite a bit. And there's so much focus on neurodiversity, and rightfully so, because we have evidence to support, yeah, differences in neuronal activity, action, these sorts of things. Expanding that to the entire body, mind, and including the connective tissue seems really important. Back to, well, my nervous system is made up of cells and tissues. So this takes us into hypermobility. Hypermobility isn't necessarily just being, you know, flexible and being able to touch your toes. It's your connective tissue, the density of your connective tissue. I suspect that that is part of all of it, all neurodiversity into neurodivergence. Again, this type of approach might take us into a different taxonomy too. Sometimes I like to explore, okay, permeability, electricity, attention, these three things, how do those work together? And I watch that in my own experience, or I'll watch it with my clients. I'll have them watch their own experience to include your own sensitivity and be curious about that. What can we learn?
So, Rachel, what do you find particularly challenging about being neurodivergent in your life, in your world, in your work?
Oh, cool. I want to find ways to share more of this, to create spaces for more of this type of exploration, to share my work outside of a one-on-one context, and I am often very fearful of not being understood or not having a place or a space to slot myself into in cultural norms. So that's a super honest answer. There's a lot of self-doubt around processing and communication, I think.
Whether you can translate how you are within to other people, would you use the word translate? Or do you feel like it's more about being able to just be as clear as possible in your own language and hope that other people understand it?
When I'm working, and to be very clear, work is like collaborating all the time. It's absolutely rooted in a co-creative paradigm. When I'm working with other people or small groups, it's not so much a thing. But when there's no reciprocity and actual relationship to move with, it gets really, who am I speaking to? Without that form or without that relationship, it can become really confusing for me. And so dialing in where and how and who to talk to all becomes a really interesting proposition. And I think I'm navigating that now. And then trusting that people are interested in the influence of the unseen and people want to explore the leading edges, and that going beyond convention is 100% necessary. And like, yeah, I can be a part of that, right? Jump into that. And then you immediately confront all this stuff, all the beliefs that live in your own body that keep you a little bit tentative about that.
Well, I think a lot of us certainly know very well what it is to feel like a weirdo. You get into the territory of belonging and the issues that, of course, family constellation work is so steeped in, is our need to belong and being super smart or super tall or super whatever it is that makes you obviously quite different can really threaten our sense of being safe and wanted and loved even.
Yeah, safety and belonging are inextricable for us as social species, even if we are more introverted or want to calibrate our own threshold for inputs, noise, that kind of thing. We're still a social species. And so, yeah, to be cast out, you're going to wander the desert or the plains on your own for the rest of eternity. That's built into the neurology. And that's a species-wide thing. And so for neurodivergent folks, extra interesting sensitivity to dance with there, or old scripting that lives in the body.
Particularly in your expertise of marketing, and what you've taught me a lot about is the more authentic you are, the more you'll draw and resonate with the people that are most eager for what you have to share, of course. And yet there is that risk, like, oh my God, if I put out what I really, really, really think and what I really, really, really care about, am I going to be even weirder and even more outcast? Or am I finally going to find, as people say, my tribe, you know? And there is that huge risk and that lag that, unless you're somebody who just goes viral, it can take months or years or even a lifetime to find out, wow, I finally know what it is that I stand for and what I truly love. And am I going to find the people who love it too?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Scary. In the world of social media as well, of course, adds a whole other dimension to it.
Yeah. Weird extra layers of representation and norms and behaviors and all of these things. But yeah, it's shifting. We're seeing the disintegration of institutions and structures and the mutability of our world. That's more and more obvious, I think, than it's ever been. May you live in interesting times. Yeah, I feel like the rest of my lifetime is going to be marked by watching some shifting and changing in the external world. And so that adaptability or that surfing it doesn't mean it's not scary. But how do I dial this in a very regenerative time where there's a lot of composting of the old and building of the new happening?
Yeah, that's for sure.
That's wacky.
Hey, folks, if there's anything you want to ask, I so highly recommend and encourage you to put it out there. Yay, Liz! So nice to see you here.
Lovely to tune in with you live. First of all, I love the work you both do and bring into the world, and the honor to the body is just amazing. So I'm wondering, and the classroom is my playground, and embodied educator is what I tend to bring into the world. And there's a big challenge of diversity in our classrooms. And that's what I'm trying to slowly bring to my colleagues. Like, how do we work with, especially in the role of educator, where you're an exemplar and you live by example, but you have often a mix in your classroom of all different beautiful bodies. Yeah, how do we create a creative and safe space at the same time when we're all so differently attuned, maybe?
Oh, that's such a beautiful question, Liz, and nice to meet you. So I have ideas. I don't have answers.
It's lovely. That's a start, right?
And I appreciate so deeply that challenge. I work with a good friend of mine in neurodivergent and inclusive educational practices. And yeah, that's a real challenge, especially teacher volume of students. You teach children, adults, teenagers?
No, I'm actually in university.
University, okay.
Of applied sciences. But then I think classroom might not be that different, but my followers are both university and primary and high school. Yeah.
The first thing that comes up, modeling self-attunement and leadership from a very early age with little ones. So I have a client and a friend who she and her son, when he was young, authored this children's book around polyvagal theory. And it's a robot who has three different internal states, green, red, and blue. And that's sort of like that awareness of that somatic awareness in preschoolers and kindergartners and these kinds of things. So this is all happening through scale and time. But what we see is modeled for us by a leader is equally as important, if not more so, as what they say. And so that coming into that modeling of self-attunement feels really, really important throughout the developmental lifespan. And in theory, if we were able to excerpt and be in a different dimension where this has been happening on Earth for some time now, that self-attunement would hopefully lead to a dynamic where students would be able to take what they needed, ask for what they needed. They would feel comfortable learning in the ways that supported them. So what would that look like? Moving around, jotting things down, maybe like having visuals. And it is this sort of like engaging community space where, yes, the teacher is holding the space and there is a sort of structure to how this learning is going to happen, but that all those students would feel attuned to their own needs to be able to learn how they needed to. That would be where I would hope we would be able to get. So just really at this point, I feel like teachers modeling that learn your own learning style. What do you need to feel interested and excited and engaged? And that's where it gets back to that autodidact in me is follow your nose. What interests you? And even developing curriculum around that, that is so much more build your own thing that is interesting to you. Do it in a way that resonates with you. You're still accountable to engage it, but if there's self-design, it's more inclusive. So that, I think that's just the first thing that comes up, but there's a lot to this pragmatically.
I actually want to add something to that because my work, Personal Geometry, sorry to put another plug in unintentionally, but I have both my business coach and my social media manager here, and I'm trying to learn this from them too. But I took that work to a university class on business ethics, because a student of mine is the professor in it. And it was amazing to just in an hour and a half, give them a language by which these students could explore what their body thought and felt and saw and understood about these different views of ethics and how they were going to write a term paper about the ethics of the corporation that they had been assigned or that they chose. And the kids immediately, from the minute they walked in the door and saw the chairs in a circle rather than in lines, their bodies, I would just sit there across from the door and watch them respond just from a different configuration of the chairs, let alone having a different, again, language and different method to be able to explore thought through this visual palpable way of learning was amazing. It was so fruitful. And they were much more enthusiastic about writing those blasted term papers about these super heady constructs about different ways of viewing the ethical world. So that's what I wanted to add to that as well. And we've got two questions, and then we're probably going to have to wrap up. Let's see. How can we navigate the tension between valuing individual uniqueness and fostering a sense of belonging in a diverse community or organization? Yeah,
that's a good one. Actually, Practicing what I preach. I need 2 seconds, Allie. I'll be right back. I would love to have you take a stab at answering it, and I will return in 90 seconds.
Yeah. So to me, what this really gets into is how the other has become a negative and hateful thing that we, I won't say we necessarily, but that many people are fearing more and more. So if people look different than we do, whether that's a different race, a different shape, or a different species, then because we don't understand it, and it's obvious it's from a different circumstance and life experience, then we assume it's something that could be potentially threatening. And therefore, uniqueness becomes dangerous rather than an opportunity. I think it's so interesting, the word tension. That's such a visceral kind of word. Why is it a tension when something's different? Because we don't know. I mean, even if you meet somebody who looks very much like you, there can be a sense of, am I going to be seen? Am I going to be heard? Am I going to be able to commune with this person? Or are those differences so great that we won't be able to meet in the middle or overlap or merge? So I think that's part of course, the excitement of life is every person you meet, there's the possibility that you're going to be able to interface with them in new and exciting and fruitful ways. And there's also the possibility that there'll be conflict and potentially even violence and abuse. We don't know really with anybody we encounter until either let our bodies, hopefully more and more, I'm trying to learn that. What does my body already know about this person I've just met in seconds, rather than just coming from looking and all of a sudden all the associative data giving me information that might be completely skewed based on, as we know, prejudice and past experience and et cetera, et cetera. Mm. I don't know if you heard all of that, Rachel, but
the tail end, yes. And yeah, one thing I haven't, it's so embodied for me. It's so resonant. And it's not lost on me that we have been speaking very conceptually and in a zoomed out place. Zooming in a little bit, nervous system awareness. Is it safe to be different? And I think we're conditioned with the messaging that it's not. Like, you're supposed to be different in some very narrow, same way. So this gets really into, is it safe to be different? And that's a big, it's a big exploration, which is what I hear you saying, Allie.
Well, the answer is it is with some people and not with others. And the more our bodies, as you use that phrase, Rachel, given a seat at the table, that we can acknowledge and learn what it is that they know, that we know as a whole being, as a whole body, I think it perhaps gets easier to navigate those differences and those similarities. Yeah.
Yeah, holding a truth that we are simultaneously same and different.
Yeah.
And humanity, species level sameness, unique individuality, can we hold both of those? And the nervous system, when we're in a survival state, it is more binary. The more survival, the more us versus them, the more me versus you. So one trick I will give when I'm working with clients is if you notice a lot of binary, this or that, right or wrong, either or in yourself, that's an invitation to get really curious about the tension in your body, the state of your nervous system. Your body is communicating that you're not safe. And that's a very different way of seeing your own experience rather than through just the thoughts, back to that identification with thoughts thing.
I love that. It makes me think about the effect of all that fried food on one's sense of safety.
Yes. Oh, God.
Okay, one more question, two more questions. As you've matured and become more self-aware about your own reality, internal, external balance, have you struggled with dealing with the, let's say, contrast between yourself and the less matured, less balanced world at large? If so, how do you maintain your hopefulness, optimism?
I'm a big fan of shadow work. Emergence work, letting what comes up come up, the seeing and the sense of self and the ego, or how I position myself as part of this world or separate from it. There's all this stuff around that, but am I safe to be in this world? It comes back to that, honestly, for me. If I cut through all of it, am I safe to co-create in this world? because you can go right back to that from all of that. Sometimes I feel like I am, and sometimes I feel like I'm not. And I know that I really want to. And I know that that's a journey. And I know that I'm the same, and I know that I'm different at the same time. And so it comes back to, am I in the game or am I not in the game? Do I want to be in the game or do I want to hide? Yeah, that, because I can spin up incredibly complex, elaborate stories about that stuff. But if I'm being really honest and really kind and really compassionate with myself, it's, does this matter enough for me to get out there and live in it? The hopefulness part would be an honoring of the agency I have or the influence that I do have or could have. None of us are single-handedly going to shift this on our own. If we try to go it alone, it's not going to work.
Yeah. And the shorthand of my answer to that is, when you recognize some of that sameness, you got to cherish it. Okay. What will it mean to be human in 50 years? How is it different than today? I don't know if you want to answer that before we sign off, but...
It'll mean whatever we collectively have shifted it to mean. Hopefully that's more inclusive. Hopefully that includes intelligence that is nonverbal. Hopefully that includes ways of being that are creative and experimental and sufficiently both sensitive and resilient. And it'll be a journey, but I don't know what that's going to look like. I like to hold space for being surprised at how quickly things could shift. There are these examples of small collective action that could grind the global economy to a halt, for example. So I don't know how it's going to go, but I hope that it means something more beautiful and it includes a little bit more of the sacred and it is more inclusive.
Yeah, and I just hope we're all around. Well, I won't be around then, but in 50 years, I hope humans are still around and hopefully cohabitating much more gracefully with the other species in the world. Mm-hmm. And I hope that we as humans learn how to love a whole lot more than we tend to now. So thank you all so much for being here with us. And thank you, Rachel, so much for coming back around again. And I'm sure we'll have you again. And I want to just thank you so much. And Flo just put in the chat that if you want to find out, and I highly recommend you do, more about what Rachel's doing or need a superb, and I would go so far as to say magical coach, Rachel is still working one-on-one until we are informed otherwise. And I highly recommend her work. And I highly recommend my work too. And I'm about to start another class. I'm teaching one now, and a new cohort of personal geometry starts in June, if you're at all interested in checking that out. I wish you all just a beautiful rest of your day or night and life. And hopefully our paths will cross again soon. So thank you all for being here.
Yeah, bye. Thank you all.
Bye.
We did it.
We did it.
Hey.
How are you feeling?
It's a good question. Not sure.
I feel like I wish we could all sit down and have a big beep drink of something. It's tea or otherwise. That's how I'm feeling. Wow.
Yeah, I feel like those questions were so big.
They were huge. And I'm sorry I didn't ask littler ones, but...
It's okay. Big questions get big responses, and then I get nervous because I'm like, they're not tangible enough. They feel tangible to me.
Yes.
My body. They're not like disembodied. That's that tension we've talked about when people will give me feedback. They're like, you sound really heady or you sound really academic, but it's in my guts. it's in my chest.
Really interesting. I wish we'd talked about that too. That sounds really interesting.
That's one of those weird points. I'm kind of melting over here right now and going through a little fun little goop reemergence. And that thing about authentic voice and getting this feedback my whole life of being so academic and smart in this way that is disembodied, or the way that people will reflect it back to me. And then this fundamental, like, no, it's very rooted to me. That gets confusing because I want to be able to bring that signature along? And so do I have to use fewer words? Do I have to not be myself? Do I have to use different types of language? Because that thing, what we just did, I'm like, okay, did I sound really heady? Did I make sense to people? Was this way too zoomed out? Do you see what I'm saying?
I totally see what you're saying. And probably everybody would have a different answer. For me, it's not too heady because I can think that way. For somebody else, it might be. And I was concerned about that too, is this tangible? Same word I was thinking too, is this tangible enough? And how do we make it more tangible, or how can I elicit more tangible things, but instances or descriptions? But I think what you just said, you had mentioned earlier, and I think we talked about this in episode two, is that the body also thinks, and you just described just now that your body is inextricably your mind. Mm-hmm. And that I think is so helpful to even describe, because is that unusual to you, or are all of us doing that much more than we even realize, because we were taught to think in a classroom with our bodies completely frozen and still and not to notice them, because you're supposed to be noticing the blackboard or noticing what you're supposed to be writing or reading. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know, but I think it's such an interesting conversation to bring, to help people understand you, that that's how you experience it, but also potentially to help us understand that we're doing it too.
Yeah. Flo, I'm curious.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily the language you use or the way that you describe it. I think it's something that people aren't used to, something that they haven't felt. So it's even harder for them to make the correlation between what you're saying and what the actual feeling or experience can be. Mm. So that's one of my thoughts, is maybe that is just you're actually describing something very unknown to people, which is difficult in itself.
Yes.
On top of it being your own specific experience of this, of all of it. So,
yeah.
But I mean, I like the way you describe it, even if it's not the way I would describe it. And I have to say, I do not speak the same way as you, but I have people often needing me to rephrase my descriptions of things that I'm trying to explain to them, things that seem really natural and easy to me, usually about gardening or something like that. I have to explain it a few times for them to understand my experience of it.
Yeah, it is less about my experience, and it's more about you can learn how to think with your entire body.
Sure. Yeah.
That's one way to talk about what we're talking about here, that you can, you can cultivate a relationship with your nonverbal intelligence.
Yeah.
And I guess I could say it more plainly that way. It doesn't stop there, but this tension of sounding academic, I've never liked that, because it doesn't feel academic. It doesn't feel like it's floating. It feels very tethered to my body. So when I get feedback that like the language I use comes off that way, I'm always, but no!
Explain it to a five-year-old. Pretend you're explaining it to a five-year-old. Does that help? Because what you said was very concise and accurate.
Yeah.
It's kind of poetic. I mean, everyone uses language in their own different way.
Yeah.
The bigger the dimensions you're describing, and you think in a vast way, but you also have this, as you call it, your taxonomy brain, where you're able to take the massive and the meta and, chunk it down into this elegant configuration or pattern on multiple levels, to the cellular, but also to the practical, in ways of, for example, how are you going to market something? How are you actually going to translate what your huge worldview is, or your life's work is, into a brand, a logo, a newsletter? So you're doing that all the time, top to bottom, bottom to top. But I think also that Flo, hopefully our audience, are interested in these larger conversations that don't tend to happen. Part of the reason why I wanted to create the Brilliant Body podcast is because these are the conversations that turn me on. This is how I want to be talking. This is this. I could talk
about these things every damn day of my life. Yeah. And I am starving for these conversations because they're about what I'm most interested in. And almost every place I go in the world are not talking about this stuff. And even if you go to an academic institution, they're not bringing together and interweaving. They're not interdisciplinary. They're not including the intelligence of the body, for example, in these academic institutions.
Well, it's only reductive. Yeah, it's only reductive and it's predicated on, yeah, everything you just said, Allie. That's exactly right. That's my sweet spot. Who am I to occupy that spot and be big and be a public anti-academic intellectual? Not anti-academic. Weave it in, inclusive. Yeah. There have to be these other ways of exploring.
Yep. Everyone has their own audience, and you're describing something similar to what a lot of our other guests have described, but they've done it in a completely different way. And maybe you're the one who's going to be able to tap into that audience who do exist on a very heady plane. And maybe you're the one who's going to be like, oh, it's okay to be heady and embodied at the same time. It's not exclusive. Maybe you're the one that they're going to be like, wow, I get this. I get this. She's explaining in my language.
Right on. So I totally agree. Yeah. And I do want to also bring in, though, the trauma of giftedness that can occur, because those of us who were considered gifted, and that, of course, is problematic in itself. You know, who got to go to those special classes and get that extra time and only 6 students to a professor who got to work with really bright kids who were really motivated to learn, and then go back into another environment, either the rest of the classroom or home for that matter, and it not being okay to be really bright, and it not being okay to be really curious and really verbal or verbose, as the case may have been, or whatever it is, that there could be a lot of difficulty, which could happen in any sector. I mean, you can be incredibly athletic and also get into trouble, or you could be anything that's at one end of a spectrum of the average and have trouble integrating into other things. And it can be traumatic to, again, our need to belong. So I just wanted to add that in too, that coming out with one's intelligence in this case, or unusual experience of intelligence, which is very much embodied in your case, in all of our cases for that matter, is definitely cutting oneself from the herd potentially.
Yeah.
Are we going to get gobbled by something with big teeth? Or are we going to find the rest of our weirdo species, you know?
Yeah, I was thinking about that this morning. This interesting paradox, or I've painted myself into this corner of hiding as a way to keep myself safe, but I'm cutting myself off from pretty much any belonging or most belonging anyways. So there's actually more possibility of, let's say, that connection and belonging by externalizing the difference, showing the self, being vulnerable. But that's so edgy to the neuroception, to the nervous system. I can go hike around Nepal. I can go get hypoxia. I can go hang out in Alaska and do all these things that are very externally fear-based, but then being visible, and there's this Mobius strip of this lie, this subtle lie that's like you hide to keep yourself safe, but there's no belonging there either. So put yourself out there, that hits directly on something that's way edgier to me than a grizzly bear rolling up on camp. Like literally,
yeah, you had to talk me down from sharing my, you know, raw despair to, yeah, yeah, in yeah, a newsletter the other day when I was sobbing to you. And even though you were saying that was so incredibly resonant.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, it is. Why aren't I sharing this? Because that's where we humans connect. And yet you were like,
well, you reworked it, gave it time, and it came out amazing. That's a perfect example of let the scroll within flow, and then it gets...
No, but that was a fraction of what I was really experiencing.
It wasn't a fraction. It wasn't a volume thing. It's a time thing. It's the distillate. It's how the emotion is carried. It's how the density is conveyed. How that got sent out was beautiful. And I'm not asking you to always be in your center, but there was a center of gravity in what you were saying in that newsletter when it came out. Whereas when you were just first processing it with me, it was like, you know, like this. So that's a perfect example of discernment, inclusion, but also time, giving it time. Yeah, do it with everybody else. Doing it with yourself is fucking impossible.
No, come on.
No, no. Well, anyways, I hope this was what we needed it to be.
Hey, I loved it. Really, I love the conversation. And hopefully a lot of other people will love it too.
Thanks so much for sticking around till the end. If you enjoyed this episode, please give that like button a little click. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and hit that notification bell. I've got a bunch of fascinating guests lined up with trailblazing experts in the field that I'm really excited to share with you. I'm eager to hear from you too, so don't be shy. Drop a comment below. Share your thoughts, suggestions, or just say hi. Your insights on this episode mean the world to me. So go ahead, spread some love, like, subscribe, hit the bell, and share your thoughts below. Your support keeps this channel going strong, and I'm genuinely grateful for each and every one of you. Till next time, stay brilliant. I hope you found this episode inspiring. If you'd like to learn more about the many ways I'm encouraging and guiding the wider world to reclaim the brilliance of the body, please visit my website at www.alimezey.com. Thanks so much for listening. Until the next episode and beyond, reclaim your brilliant body. The Brilliant Body Podcast was created by Ali Mazay. This episode was co-produced and edited by Ali Mazay and Florence Popoff. Thanks to composer Blair, Mr. One Man Ben Wilson, for my theme music.